From the Umzelit Grand Center Community Room, welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Well, it is over, finally over. Election 2016, with its stunning national result, is now history. A Republican wave swept the country, and Missouri Republicans were victors here as well. The wave seized the top races in the Show Me State. To a certain degree, Illinois bucked the trend. In the wake of the tsunami, lots of second-guessing going on. The question is, how and why did the election turn as it did, and what now? Joining me and our community room audience are St. Louis Public Radio political reporters Joe Manis and Jason Rosenbaum, as well as Terry Jones, the founder's professor of political science and public policy administration at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. Well, here we are, the day after the night before. Terry, let me begin with you. Is it possible to separate the outcome in Missouri from the results of the national election?
Not really. The Trump effect helped, indeed, Republicans in Missouri have even larger margins than they might otherwise have had by increasing the relative turnout in exurban areas and rural areas.
Mm-hmm. Joe, your take on that connection?
Yeah, I think it's obvious. If you look at, there was two things going on. There was the Trump effect that fueled turnout in like the far suburbs and in rural Missouri. And for whatever reason, urban and near suburban turnout was down slightly. It was down about 50,000 votes in St. Louis County, St. Louis City, and Kansas City combined. But frankly, the margins of victory were so huge, even if they'd been the same as in 2012, the Democrats still would have lost across the board statewide. It just would have been closer.
Jason?
I think that we were discussing before the election about how the actual margin of Trump's expected victory would affect the outcome. I think that we thought that maybe it would be anywhere from 10 to 15 points, 10 being more realistic at the time, 15 being like the ceiling. Well, it got to almost 20 points. I think a little under 20 points was his margin of victory. And I don't care how talented you are of a politician or how good of a campaign you've run, if your presidential nominee loses the state by 20 percentage points and your opponent hasn't made a catastrophic Todd Akin-like mistake, you're not going to win an election. And that's exactly what happened to Missouri Democrats yesterday.
Terry, the polls nationally and regionally were way, way, way off. Why do you think that was?
Well, I think that's one too many ways, but they were way off. The speculation goes back to the so-called shy Trump voters, individuals particularly in live phone interviews who were not comfortable saying that they were planning to vote for Trump, so either said that they were undecided or maybe for a third-party candidate. It only took 2 to 3 to maybe as many as 4% of the electorate to fit that profile to cause the results to change from the ones reported to the actual election results. There is a call within my own profession through the American Association of Public Opinion Researchers in emails today having an investigation, a study, a commission to figure out precisely with the best possible evidence what happened, what went wrong, and what could be done to fix it.
Jason?
Now, I know in Missouri there was especially big glaring problems with some of the live polls. A lot of the sample sizes were 400 people, which I will go to my grave saying that's too small of a sample size. In fact, I had been critical of some automated poll services like Remington because, from my understanding, automated polls tended to have a lot of people not answer them because they think they're junk calls. But in an example of me possibly eating crow, I think that the automated polls, and we'll have to look at the research, may have been more accurate in this situation, at least nationally, because of what Professor Jones just said. So I can admit I was wrong on that one, but I thought that the Missouri polling had some serious structural problems.
Before we go to Joe, Terry, what's the margin for error typically in a poll of 400 people?
Plus or minus 5% at the 95% confidence level. That's going to be on the final exam, Don.
Yeah.
Okay, Joe.
Well, and I think a couple things people shouldn't miss. I mean, with all the votes in, Hillary Clinton actually won the popular vote. So she's in the same league with Al Gore, winning the popular vote and not winning the White House because she didn't get the right combination of electoral votes. But if you look at what we've been talking about, where she really lost ground was Pennsylvania, those places where you have a lot of disaffected working class whites. That's the, I think, one of the big takeaways. I'm not sure whether what Trump is promising to do will help or not, because some of the Republican leaders in Congress aren't really on board with some of his proposals. And it's the same way in Missouri. So it's going to be intriguing over the next couple of years to see sort of what happens and how people, if they see what they want to happen, happen. But I think this really underscores the divide in the country, the economic divide, and the real frustration of people who have seen over the last 30 years in particular, the livelihoods of their family and their children just gone. And a lot of this, we're going to have to see over the next decade if that changes.
Well, the public has expressed its concerns. Jason, what now? Particularly here in Missouri, what happens now with this massive change at the top?
I tend to engage in a lot of hyperbole, probably for comedic effect. But I can say without any hyperbole that yesterday was the most triumphant day in the history or the modern history of the Missouri Republican Party, and the worst day ever for the Missouri Democratic Party ever, even in non-modern history. Missouri has actually traditionally either been a swing state or a Democratic state on a local level. I think in the 1800s, there weren't even viable Republican challengers for U.S. Senate and Democratic governor. Now we're in a situation where Republicans won, I believe, 7 statewide elections last night, if you include the presidential race, which has never happened before. You're going to have a governor-elect in Eric Greitens come into office with super majorities, which basically means he'll be able to do whatever he and the legislature want. And I can't emphasize enough how good yesterday was for Missouri Republicans and how bad it was for Missouri Democrats. It could be years, if not a decade, before the Democrats turn it around at this point.
Before we turn to Joe, let's listen to a sound clip of Eric Greitens as he was speaking last night with Rachel Lipman about what he sees as the immediate future of his administration. Here's Eric Greitens.
You know, our mission is very clear. It's more jobs and higher pay, safer streets and better schools for the people of Missouri. The people of Missouri are looking for us to get results, and that's what we're going to do. There are so many people who are counting on us, kids who want to make sure that they've got a fair shot at the American dream, and we're going to make sure that that happens here in the state of Missouri.
Eric Greitens, the governor-elect here in the state of Missouri. Joe, you wanted to comment.
Yeah, well, I think one thing that's undoubtedly will happen within the next few months after he takes office in January is Missouri will become a right-to-work state. The General Assembly, the Republican majority, has been charged by supporters and donors for some time to get this through. They've done it before, but it's always been blocked by Governor Jay Nixon. This will get through. This will be signed by Greitens. This is a major defeat for labor. They will probably go after some of the public employee unions as well. There will be kind of a realignment. Now, this will be a test of the philosophical question. Some say that this will lead to more jobs. The critics say it will lead to more jobs, but lower paying jobs. But we're going to see this over the next couple years. This will happen. This is not a test. This will happen, and supporters of this will be very happy, and critics will not. But this is going to be a major change in Missouri within the next 6 months.
You have to keep in mind that with one-party control comes one-party accountability. So the kind of statements that Governor-elect Greitens made last night are now going to be part of what Republicans will be held for account when it comes up for re-election in 2020. The parties can no longer, when you have that one-party situation, blame the other party for blocking their agenda.
Well, but I have to make this point. One of the reasons why I made the statement that it may be a long time before the Democrats recover is because all their statewide candidates that could have run for governor in 2020 lost yesterday. And the only statewide non-U.S. senator that remains is Nicole Galloway, the state auditor, who's a Democrat who was appointed last year. And I think it's assured that she's going to face a tough Republican challenger in 2018. And there's not much of a bench really right now for the Democrats to take on Greitens. But to be fair, 4 years is an eternity in Missouri politics. 4 years ago, Jay Nixon, the Democratic governor, won re-election, I think, by double digits. So I agree with Professor Jones that with great power comes great responsibility and great accountability. And if there's overreach that garners negative public support, maybe Democrats have a shot to take back some ground in 4 years.
I would also say, Jason, that neither party lacks a bench. Each party has individuals who get up every morning, look in the mirror, and see themselves as the next governor, and are thinking about that as part of their long-term future. Eric Greitens was certainly doing that 4 years ago, and we were not mentioning his name at all.
I think also Claire McCaskill, Senator Claire McCaskill, she's up for re-election in 2018. She's now in the middle of the bullseye, and there's going to be a number of Republicans who'll be deciding whether or not to challenge her. I think she's probably, she was in New York yesterday with Clinton. I'm sure that McCaskill is already considering some of her options because she had hoped to be looking at a Senate chairmanship. Now, the Republicans stay in control of the Senate. She's going to be embattled from the Republican majority back home. And I think she's going to decide whether she wants to run for re-election or what. And another person affected is U.S. Rep. Ann Wagner, who had been considered a likely challenger to Claire McCaskill. Wagner has been under fire the last few weeks from Republicans because she unendorsed Trump, although she went on the radio and said she was voting for him. I think there's going to be a lot of other Republicans who step up and say, I have the right to run for the U.S. Senate, not you, because you were not a true Trump supporter. So there's going to be a lot of little things going on within the Republican Party over the next couple years in Missouri, because they're definitely going to be angling to take back that U.S. Senate seat.
Before we pursue that, I have to take a break. Let's do that now. Hold your thought, Jason. It looked like you were getting ready to say something, but perhaps not. In any case, we'll come back in just a minute. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back to the community room here at UMSL at Grand Center, where we are talking about the outcome of yesterday's election nationally and regionally. My guests in our studio down in that community room are Terry Jones, political science professor, Joe Manis, political reporter for St. Louis Public Radio, and our colleague Jason Rosenbaum, also with St. Louis Public Radio. Jason, I perhaps thought you were going to say something a moment ago, but was I wrong?
Yes, but did you have a question?
It's not the first time I've been wrong, by the way. Well, let me put it this way. We've been talking about the political futures of some of the people involved in yesterday's election. Let's talk about Chris Koster.
Right.
What sort of a future do you see for him after yesterday's loss?
Well, I could see a future of him joining a trial attorney firm and making lots and lots of money. He is a very talented attorney. And frankly, he's a very talented political figure. And in any other year, I think he probably would have won this race. But I think a lot of things went against him. Obviously, his presidential candidate losing by almost 20 points was not helpful. I also think his strategy of trying to garner conservative bona fides by stressing his pro-National Rifle Association and pro-agriculture commodity group support obviously didn't help him in the rural parts of the state. And when you look at Chris Koster's campaign against Eric Greitens and the attacks that he was throwing at him, including saying that because Eric Greitens took about $700,000 worth of a salary over like a 6 or 7 year period, he was pocketing money that should have gone to veterans. Those attacks didn't strike me as particularly effective when I saw them watching TV. So you don't always win in politics. If Trump proves to be unpopular, I do think that maybe he can jump back in the fray in some form or fashion, because despite this loss, which I know is probably bitterly disappointing to him, he is still a very talented politician. And I think that he could potentially try to take the Mel Carnahan route and come back after a loss and try for something else.
Before we go to the other panelists, let's hear from Chris Koster, the statement he made following his election loss last night.
My prayer is that all of Missouri's chosen leaders will make time to listen and learn from those of different backgrounds to gain a greater appreciation for the vast complexity of the state that we love. And by doing so, find common purpose regarding the difficult challenges before us. Thank you all for your faith, trust, and friendship. And good night.
That's Chris Koster, conceding last night after losing the gubernatorial race to Eric Greitens. Joe and Terry, did you want to comment on Mr.
Koster? Let's remember that you can get one loss in politics if it's an excusable loss and still not ruin your reputation as an off candidate for office. For example, Kip Bond was upset by Joe's T-tail in 1976, came back in 1980 to be reelected governor, and then went on to have several terms in the U.S. Senate. Chris Koster is an exceptional political talent, has a very strong record in government. If he wishes to run for office again, he will still be a formidable candidate. But the times have to be right for that to happen.
Yes.
Joe?
Yeah, one thing I want to emphasize, I think for all our talk about Trump, and the Trump effect was real, and this was why, you know, arguably why Democrat Jason Kander didn't knock off Senator Roy Blunt, because Kander only lost by 3 percentage points. I don't want to take any away from the victors. Greitens ran a very smart and disciplined campaign. Blunt ran a very smart and disciplined campaign. Eric Schmidt, who's going to be the new state treasurer, ran a very smart and disciplined campaign. The Republicans, victors, they all ran. This wasn't a case of them just accidentally winning because of Trump, although he helped them a lot. Most, all of them down the line ran very sharp, focused campaigns, and I don't want to take away from those victories. And I'm not just saying that. If you look at each of those contests, the Republicans were strong going in, even without Trump.
And they also didn't make any major mistakes, even when they were being attacked by their Democratic opponents. Even Democratic opponents like Chris Koster and Jason Kander, who had significant financial resources. The other benefit for some of the down ballot people that Joe mentioned was they were able to substantially outraise their Democratic opponents, and money does matter in those types of situations.
Okay. Lots to talk about. We have a question from our audience. Dan is standing by. Dan, state your question, please.
Yes, I have two items. If the Electoral College was eliminated, how would that change campaigning? And the second is there's a lot of controversy over Comey's comments before the election. I wonder if analyzing the early balloting would be an indication of what kind of effect it had.
If the let me take the first question. If the Electoral College were eliminated, and it was the whoever won the most of the national popular vote, it would change where the candidates campaign. Now they're in states that are close in terms of the outcome for the electoral votes. If it was the national popular vote, it would be the larger states. You would not see them in North Dakota or South Dakota ever. Okay.
Yeah, I think you'd see them along the coasts and all that. I think people will be studying the whole issue of Comey's letter, the FBI director's initial letter, for a long time. The Democrats, I think, are convinced that he stopped her momentum. They're going to blame her for her defeat. But and a little bit that may be true, but there are also the larger issues. She was not necessarily, I mean, for all her groundbreaking achievements, the fact is the public was looking for something new. They were looking for change. She did not represent change. And in some ways, frankly, I think that Vice President Joe Biden might have been actually a stronger Democratic choice, because he could tap into that working white middle class angst. And so he might have been able to change things. Maybe not, because this said, I mean, Trump really, when you think about it, the last couple of weeks, the man and his vice presidential nominee, Mike Pence, were virtually campaigning on their own. They had no major Republicans out there helping him or not. And they still pulled this off. I think you cannot denigrate what Trump in particular did. I mean, the man won, and he won decisively, even by losing the popular vote. And he did it pretty much single-handedly.
And despite all the immense controversies in the last few weeks that Trump encountered over his words and his arguably incendiary statements, both past and present, I mean, obviously, the majority of voters in key states didn't find that to be disqualifying. So that has to also be taken into consideration.
He asked about the Comey effect also. We can debate what kind of an effect that had nationally, but let me ask the two reporters who've been in the field, Jason and Joe, do you think the Comey situation, his comments, first and second comments, had any effect here in Missouri?
Well, I can just say that I think that the first Comey letter, I don't know, did that come out on a Friday?
Yes, yeah. It did.
It came out, I think, on the same time Jason Kander was having a rally in St. Louis with Joe Biden, around the same time.
Yes.
I stayed up until 3:30 in the morning last night, so my timeline may be a little skewed, but it was, I felt something in that rally, like it was probably the pinnacle of Jason Kander's campaign. He was getting tons of national exposure, he had a lot of momentum, and then when that letter hit, something inside me felt like this could be a momentum stopper, not only for Clinton, but for Kander and other Democrats as well. Whether or not it was a fair thing to be a momentum stopper, sometimes things affect the outcome of races, whether they're practically significant or not, and that one might be one of them.
Joe?
Yeah, I think there were several Senate races around the country that may have been affected by that, including Kander's, but as far as below that, I don't really think Comey's letter had much effect on the Greitens-Costa race, for example. I really don't think it did, other than, as I said, it may have prompted, emboldened more people who were thinking about Trump to vote for him, and maybe when they were in the polls, they pulled the button all the way down for Republicans. But as I've said a million times, we do not have straight ticket voting in this state, so people had to go through and vote for every contest. So there was some thought. So I'm not sure if it had much effect on the statewide offices other than the Kander-Blunt race.
Past incidents that are similar to that have not shown much impact on actual voting, people changing their mind because X said Y or X did something. But they can take the momentum out of the campaign organization and the campaign volunteers. So it's more of a second order effect than a direct one.
I wonder how many people made up their mind, what percentage of voters made up their mind in, let's say, the last 48 hours. Terry, is there any kind of research on that sort of thing?
Normally, in presidential elections, that's well under 5%.
Under 5%. Okay.
In presidential elections.
Okay. We have another question from our audience, so let's bring in Michael. Michael, your question, please.
So I was taught and always believed that the news media is an important check on the politicians in our political system. How concerned should we be with the attacks from the Trump campaign on the news media?
I think we'll have to wait and see. I mean, because he was before the election talking about suing the New York Times and some other outlets. I don't know. I mean, I think we're going to wait and see.
I think there's cause for concern based on what Joe said. I think there's also going to be a lot of reflection about how the media covered this campaign. I think that Trump definitely struck a real vein of upsetness and discontent in the country, I think it's undeniable that when he was running in the primary, a lot of broadcast media gave him a leg up that they didn't give other candidates. I didn't see Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio's speech aired in their entirety on CNN or MSNBC. Every single Trump speech was. I didn't see either one of those candidates get time after time chances to call in over the phone when other candidates had to be live via satellite feed or live in studio. A lot of these things may seem like nitpicky stylistic things, but when this happens over and over and over and over and over and over again and starts affecting the voter mindset, yeah, I think that there has to be some thought about how the media handled that. But you know what? Regardless of that, Trump won the Republican primary fair and square, and he won the presidency. Obviously, enough people decided that he should be president. But I do think that in addition to the concern about him being litigious against news media outlets, I think that a lot of news media outlets probably are going to be doing some soul searching today.
His free airtime not only impacted other Republicans, it impacted Hillary Clinton because she wasn't getting that time either. Go ahead, Terry. Yeah.
This election demonstrated far more than anyone we've had previously that there's two types of a media now. The mainstream media, the New York Times and Washington Post of this world, were vigorous in their criticism of Donald Trump, particularly in the last month of the campaign. Retrospectively, I think when the evidence is all in, that turned out to help him because it demonstrated that the establishment was against him. But he was able to get his message out dramatically through social media. And he did so, and he was a master of using that mechanism to do his campaigning.
Okay, let's take another question from our audience. This time it's Bruce. Go ahead, Bruce.
What do you see in the near term, the future of the advice and consent process for the Supreme Court, given how them not nominating their threats not to approving or confirming Garmin, but anyone in the future if Hillary Clinton had been elected?
Well, I think it doesn't matter now what they would have done if Clinton was elected. They had been threatening to hold off. With Trump elected, I expect that vacancy will be, what I'm hearing is the vacancy is going to be filled within 100 days.
And I think it'll probably be an interesting political reversal of fortune because you've had Republicans doing all they could to stop Gardner?
Merrick Garland.
Yeah, Garland. Merrick Garland.
From getting into the Supreme Court, now you may see a lot of Democrats going all out to try to block whoever Trump picks. And this may not be Trump's only pick. It's conceivable he may be able to pick a couple of other Supreme Court justices, depending on what happens over the next couple of years. You may see someone like, you know, Clarence Thomas decide to step down because he'll be replaced by a Republican president. I'm not saying that's going to happen. But you saw during when Obama was president, a couple of left of center judges step down so they could be replaced by a Democratic president. So you could see a similar scenario unfold.
And will the Republicans, as the Democrats probably might have done also, go to using a simple majority and a simple majority only to advise and consent to a Supreme Court nomination as opposed to the 60 to break a filibuster margin?
I bet they do.
I would also. I would not take that bet.
Joe Manis, what do you think Roy Blunt is thinking this morning?
Well, I think, I'm sure he's going to reach out to Trump a bit. I think Roy Blunt is probably extremely grateful because the Trump effect, probably his race was the one that it helped the most. Roy Blunt was underperforming Trump in many Republican parts of the state, in part because Kander, while a Democrat, was using some of the basic Trump outsider theme approach. And that did resonate. As I said, Kander only lost by 3 percentage points. I think Blunt, he had been trying to become part of the Senate leadership. More of that may happen. I think he's going to be looking at a lot of the key issues that are important to him. I'm sure he's very, very grateful this morning. He's a very smart man, very skilled politician. He may end up being one of the players who try to reach out, work with Pence, for example, who is supposed to be put in charge of a lot of the domestic issues. I could see Blunt having a role in some of that.
Hold on just a second, Jason. Let's hear from Senator Blunt and what his priorities are going to be following his reelection.
I'm going to stand for principle on things like religious freedom and health care that works for families and more jobs, less government, and I look forward to that.
I think he's licking his chops, don't you?
I agree with Joe that he has to feel very grateful for everything that fell in his way. First of all, let's not take anything away from Democrat Jason Kander, who lost and is no longer a statewide official because he took the risk of running against Blunt. But I think for all intents and purposes, he ran a stellar campaign against Roy Blunt. And the fact that he only lost by 3 percentage points when Koster, who many people thought was going to do better than him, lost by 5 or 6, and the other Democratic statewide candidates lost by double digits, I think that's a credit to the campaign that he ran. But conversely, as Joe alluded to, Roy Blunt is one of Missouri's most talented and skilled political figures. He's right up there with Claire McCaskill. In fact, I would, if I had to rank them, it would either be Claire McCaskill first, Roy Blunt second, or Roy Blunt first, Claire McCaskill second. They're both in a league of their own. And Roy Blunt has run, I think, 5 or 6 statewide elections. He hasn't been successful in all of them, but that gives him the experience and the foresight to know how to run a tough campaign like this. And I think, unlike other U.S. senators, like the ones in Pennsylvania and New Hampshire, he didn't have to play this game where he had to unendorse Donald Trump to win, because I think that he knew that the argument that he was somehow derisively connected with Trump wasn't going to work in Missouri, because that argument would be from the Democrats, does Roy Blunt support the presidential candidate that the vast majority of Missourians support? It's not an effective strategy. And I think that definitely helped his cause.
Yeah, one of the interesting things will be how he and McCaskill, who have worked together well in the past, sort of, she was active in helping Kander, and I'm be curious to see if the two of them kind of still work together, or if he becomes aggressive in trying to find an opponent to go after McCaskill in 2018. But that's, again, if she decides to run for re-election.
Let's also, just to underscore a note we mentioned about Chris Koster in the past, about you can lose once and come back. Both Claire McCaskill and Roy Blunt have lost statewide prior to now, and they are, I'm agreeing with Jason, two very talented office holders.
And Jason Kander is only 35 years old, so I think he probably has a run or two left in him if he wants to. But just like Chris Koster, I think he has a lot of opportunities in the private sector if he wants to take a break from government for a while.
And he attracted a lot of national attention, a lot of national attention. So there's going to be a lot of national Democratic figures and non-political figures who are going to be, I'm sure, knocking on his door today.
That's St. Louis Public Radio reporter Joe Manis, who is part of our panel today, looking at yesterday's election results, both nationally and regionally. Also with us is Jason Rosenbaum, St. Louis Public Radio political reporter, and Terry Jones, who is well known to us as an authority on most things political here in the region. We'll be back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And we are back from the community room here at UMSL at Grand Center. We're taking a look at yesterday's election results with Jason Rosenbaum, Joe Manis, and Terry Jones. We have an audience here in the community room and a question from one member of that audience. Here is Linda.
Hi. I just want to know, do you think that there ever will be a future for a cigarette tax? Are we ever going to get it passed? And how would that happen?
That's a great question. And Joe has been looking at these longer and more thoroughly than me, but in my admittingly narrow window of reference, which is about 10 years, what I've seen is cigarette tax increases get very close to passing and then failing. I think in this instance, Amendment 3, which was, I think, the more vigorously contested cigarette tax, I don't even think it came particularly close. And the thing that I think proponents of cigarette tax increases have to overcome is they have to find a way to mitigate the immense opposition that usually come with these sort of things. This time it was from the small tobacco companies that did not want an extra surcharge that would have come from Amendment 3. And it's also from Missouri voters who smoke, who don't want to pay more for cigarettes. I mean, that's, I think those are two hurdles they have to overcome.
Well, I think the other thing is that the Amendment 3 in particular, it was such a large tax. With both of with the surcharge and the other, you're talking $1.27 a pack. And while many people don't smoke, I don't smoke. So it wouldn't have affected me. But the point is that you just look at that on paper when somebody's in the polls and they're looking on that and they're thinking, do I really want to increase the tax that much? And I think that supporters of trying to increase the cigarette tax, and we do have the lowest in the nation by far, it's only 17 cents a pack, and the norm nationally is around $1 a pack, but the supporters have to get over this trying to propose big increases. They got to quit that. I mean, if they ever want to get something passed, but they're going to have to get something small.
But yet, ironically, some of the people that oppose this, particularly some health organizations, opposed it because it was not large enough. This is, if you want to count this year as twice, this is the fourth attempt to increase the tobacco tax in the 21st century. You start off with a couple of obstacles if you are in the pro-tax side. First is about 25% of Missourians smoke, and they're not going to be particularly excited about the proposal. And about 15% of Missourians who do not smoke are no tax, nowhere, no time. So you start off with 40% against you. So you have a fairly narrow margin of error. You have to get 50% out of the 60% that are available for your support. Any type of opposition over the way the money might be spent, over some other provisions in the amendment, such as the case with private organizations receiving funds under the proposed Amendment 3, is enough to sink you. So it's a very difficult needle to thread.
We have an email from Tom on your point that 25% of the population are smokers, Terry, wondering if what kind of an impact that might have had on the election, a heavier turnout from smokers, for instance. Could that have had an impact?
Very unlikely. Usually initiative proposals or referenda proposals are not the kind of things that drive people to the polls, not nearly as much as a presidential election, as well publicized and hardly fought as the one we had this year.
Yeah, I have found that ballot initiatives as a turnout mechanism, it's typically not successful. There are exceptions. I think the 2006 stem cell amendment probably turned out people, but that was a rare instance because there was almost 30 million dollars spent there, not nearly as much even as the cigarette tax increases, which still had a lot of money spent with them.
We have an email here from Jerry, or Jeffrey, I guess it is. How much of a factor did Republican gerrymandering have on this election?
Well, it depends on what gerrymandering they're talking about. One of the biggest misconceptions in Missouri politics is this idea that lawmakers draw their own state legislative districts, which is not true. A commission or judges draw those. Now, you can make an argument that those two entities drew unfavorable maps for Democrats. For example, in the state Senate, if the commission that drew the Senate maps had paired Boone County with Howard County, then it's possible that Democrats may have been able to gain a seat in the Senate as opposed to just breaking even. Conversely, though, if they hadn't put Webster Groves in the state Senate district where Scott Sifton won re-election, I'm not sure he would have won re-election yesterday. So it cuts both ways. I think it's probably a wash. But for congressional districts, they're absolutely gerrymandered. They're not very competitive. And that would be the place where they're impacted.
Okay, let's take another question from the audience. Charlie joins us. Go ahead, Charlie.
Thank you. I'm a Republican, and I'm one of those 5%ers who didn't make up my mind until the last minute. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons that I didn't do that was because of the really apparent lack of civility we saw, certainly from one of the candidates, if not both. And to me, it was appalling. And I hope that doesn't portend a bad future for all of our upcoming elections. What impact, it was victorious though, what impact do you see that element of the campaign having on future campaigns? Is it going to get worse? Is it going to get better? Have we had enough of that?
I think it's going to depend. I mean, I was seeing some disturbing things on Twitter today, like little kids harassing Hispanic classmates this morning in some states. I mean, just things like that, which is unnerving. But on the other hand, we have survived this before. I mean, the presidential contest in 1800 between Jefferson and John Adams was extremely, extremely nasty.
Don and I remember that one well, don't we?
I was just going to say the same thing.
I mean, vicious. Vicious, vicious, vicious. And here we are over 200 years later, and we're still here. And while some of this may be unsettling, on the one hand, on the other, Trump gave what was widely seen as a very gracious speech this morning and was trying to calm some of the rumblings from some of the crowd. So I think a lot of it's going to depend on what happens over the next 6 months. I mean, if he goes on a charm offensive and, you know, really tries to calm the markets. I mean, he's a businessman, you know, so I think it'd be interesting. I think Democrats are obviously extremely disheartened. It's going to depend a lot on what happens in the next year. But I think that you may, but this worked. So you may see this for the next few cycles.
Your question brings to mind something that happened in 2015 that deeply affected me, and I know a lot of other people that cover Missouri politics, and that's Tom Schweik's tragic death. After he died, there were numerous discussions within the Missouri political world whether politics had become over the line, uncivil. There was even talk about whether anti-Semitism flowed through the veins of Missouri. And I think you saw over the last year plus that the campaign in Missouri was just as nasty as it's ever been, arguably nastier if you take the governor's race into account. There were some races where I think that people tried to be civil, but, you know, negative ads continued unabated. I will say this, though, with that other point that I just made about how people thought that there was an anti-Semitic element in Missouri politics. Missourians just elected the first Jewish governor in Missouri's history yesterday, in Eric Greitens. Eric Greitens won basically every rural county in Missouri. Many of those rural counties are deeply evangelical and probably not very Jewish. I think if there's any evidence to show that being a Jewish candidate is not a hindrance or an impediment, we saw that yesterday, whether you like Eric Greitens or not. And just like the fact that Claire McCaskill was the first female U.S. senator, or, you know, any other milestone in this state, it's something that I think we should take note of as a state, that it happened yesterday.
That having been said, Jason, there's much talk, obviously, of a need to heal nationally following this intense political campaign. Is there a need for healing here in Missouri after the campaign waged here?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I'm not sure. I'm not really sure if Republicans are going to be in a healing mood from a state point, because they're in a position to where they can do whatever they want. I think, though, that they have to take in mind that even though they can do everything they want, they have to be careful, as Professor Jones said. They can't overreach so much that they basically alienate a large percentage of the electorate. So I think that even though that the Republicans can act without, you know, reaching across the aisle to Democrats, they may want to anyways, just because overreach can be harmful for their future prospects.
But the results of the election show that nationally and in Missouri, we are very separated on our political beliefs. Let's take our own metropolitan area, for example. 74% of voters in Franklin County voted for Trump. 17% of voters in St. Louis City voted for Trump. Jefferson County, 69% for Trump. St. Louis County, 41% for Trump. We've sorted ourselves out politically as well as in other ways, and we don't see too many people who disagree with us, so we tend to think everybody is on our team, and the people who are not are strange.
Well, and I think, you know, people forget this adage of, I mean, I don't want to sound ruthless, because I'm not, but the fact is, to the victor goes the spoils. And I think that Republicans had huge wins yesterday, and they're going to feel bound that they need to deliver to the people who voted for them. I mean, we can talk all the kumbaya talk we want, but that ain't going to cut it in Jeff City. That's not going to cut it in the General Assembly. They may talk like that 2 years from now before the next election, but in the short term, that isn't going to happen because that is not what they were elected to do. And whether one likes it or not. And I think while this is extremely disheartening to Democrats, if it was reversed, it probably would be the same. But I will be very surprised if there's any sort of conciliatory talk. There may be a few nice words thrown around and maybe a few cocktail parties, but they're going to take action because that's what they were elected to do. And I think we cannot discount that.
On the subject of healing, let's hear what Tammy Duckworth had to say. She's a senator-elect from Illinois. She addressed this issue as she was accepting victory last night. Let's hear from Senator-elect Duckworth.
No matter who you voted for today, we are all in this together. President Kennedy told us that our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's futures. And we all are mortal.
Senator-elect Tammy Duckworth of Illinois, how did she buck the trend?
Well, I think that she bucked the trend because Illinois is a much more Democratic state than Missouri. And I know this from personal experience. Mark Kirk, who is the incumbent senator, was my congressman in my hometown for many years. And I think Mark Kirk should feel very gratified that he was able to stay in office, not only representing a Democratic-leaning congressional district, but also a Democratic state. His time ran out. He probably should not have run for re-election after his stroke. Frankly, I don't think any Republican could have won that seat, but he clearly was not in a position, either politically or physically, to take on Tammy Duckworth. And that race was a foregone conclusion before the night started.
Even before his comment about her heritage?
Yeah, he was going to lose no matter what. And unfortunately for him, I think that soured what was otherwise a very successful political career for Kirk. And honestly, Kirk would probably not be able to get elected in Missouri as a Republican. He would probably run as a Democrat because he's so socially liberal. Frankly, he's more liberal than Chris Koster is.
And he was swept into the 2010 wave where Republicans did so well.
Terry, you're the man with the numbers. Do you have any figures with regard to the millennial vote in Missouri yesterday?
No, there's only the national exit poll data available, and I don't have even the age breakdowns for it. Again, it's very disturbing, though, if you're thinking about a nation divided as opposed to united. The Trump vote among whites was 20 points higher. It's 58% Trump, 37% Clinton. For African Americans, 88% Clinton, 8% white. That's a huge divide. And there's also now a growing geographic divide. I've already given Missouri examples of that. But what's happening in Missouri is also happening elsewhere in the country.
Jason? Yeah. Well, go ahead, Joe.
It'll be months before there's any sort of, analysis of that, because when people go to the polls, they don't say how old they are. They don't say if they're a man or woman. So there's a lot of stuff that it's going to be conjecture, and they'll have to look at some of these exit polls. But frankly, I'm kind of sour on polls right now.
As am I.
So I'm not sure how much...
Wash your mouth out.
How much people are going to be listening to that sort of stuff. But yeah, But I do think if you just look at where the votes came from, let's say in Pennsylvania... and places like that where they'll focus on that were surprised, that I think they'll see that it was the white working class and particularly male that played decisive roles yesterday. For better or for worse, they did.
Less than a minute left. Jason, do you want to comment on the millennial aspect of it?
Well, as a millennial myself, right. I think Joe's right that it's going to take a while before we get that number. I will just say that when you look at the statewide results of statewide candidates, it was actually Generation Xers that were more successful than millennials, although Josh Hawley was born on December 31st, 1979, which proves, despite protestations from lame columnists, that Generation X is not lame when it comes to getting elected.
We're going to have to leave it right there. I'm afraid our time is up. I want to thank our panelists, Terry Jones, Joe Manis, and Jason Rosenbaum, for being with us. Also thank our audience here at the Community Room at Umzulik Grand Center for being with us. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with University of Missouri St. Louis Chancellor Emerita Blanche Tuhill about what she has learned from 150 interviews with women leaders in the region. We'll also speak with Bill Ferguson about the St. Louis International Film Festival selection Dream Killer, examining Ferguson's quest to free his son Ryan from prison following a murder conviction. Also, this program note, you can hear Joe Manis this evening on The Takeaways, two-hour post-election special, The Road Forward. It begins at 7 p.m. right here on 90.7 KWMU. Archived versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.